You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Daryl Blocker, who spent the last 3.5 decades working in the national security intelligence field, most of that was CIA. As a career operations officer, he spent time as chief of station or deputy chief of station in several capacities, and was chief of base in a war zone. From 2010 to 2013, he was deputy chief and then chief of the Interagency Training Center, which we might call a different name, but he can't. And in 2013, Daryl was made the deputy director of the Counterterrorism Center, and then in 2014, the chief of the Africa Division at CIA. There's a lot more to talk about, but let's do that within the conversation. So welcome, Daryl. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us at Spycast.
Thank you for having me. It's always interesting to hear my career being spoken to in sensitized down into such a small thing. It's still uncomfortable a little bit, but
I mean, about anyone talking about what you've done is a little uncomfortable. You're not that removed
from
the world. Well, let's now go in the Wayback Machine and talk about the kind of the beginning of your career, even pre-CIA when you're looking at the Air Force, and kind of a big question about what brought you to the world of intelligence. What was the draw? And let me predicate this question by saying, to be frank, this wasn't a time where there's a significant amount a minority representation within the intelligence community. It's not the 50s.
Right.
But there's still, it's nowhere near what it is today.
At all. Yeah. But I'm a second generation intelligence officer. And between my brother and my father and myself, more than 60 years in the intelligence community serving our nation. So my brother and father were both NCOs in the Air Force, working SIGINT or signals intelligence issues. And I believe that I don't know if it had a major impact on me, but I know all the coffee mugs in my house growing up had like secret agent guys with headphones on and, you know, cloak and dagger. I was a Cub Scout. I was a Boy Scout. I was in ROTC in high school and college. And then I joined the Air Force myself and was an analyst. So I enjoyed the collection part. I mean, I enjoyed the analytical part of it, but when I got the opportunity to be an actual collector of intelligence and answering a newspaper ad, of all things, to write a 1,500 word or less essay on anything that you felt strongly about, I wrote about the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. The first one was happening at that time, late 80s. And someone saw that I could put a sentence together and that, you know, I had reasoned thought, and a series of, you know, emails and letters, emails didn't exist outside of the DARPA project. So answered the ad and took a battery of tests, and a year and a half later, moved from Austin, Texas to Northern Virginia.
Was there a specific point in your career that you can look back and point to where you went from this could be an interesting job, or this is kind of following in my father's footsteps, to this is going to be my career? Like, was there a point in which you said, I can do this for the next 30 years?
So when you walk in the door at CIA in the early 90s, all the briefers that were talking to us like, oh yeah, 20 years from now, and you're talking to 22 to 25 year old kids, and you're saying, you know, 20, 25 years from now when you retire, and all of us are looking at each other like, I don't know if yes. I'm going to be here for that long. I think I was probably on my third tour in West Africa where I started to realize that it started to coalesce. All the things that I had been taught started to make sense. And I was like, not only can I do this, I think I can do it really well. So I didn't recruit in my first tour. I didn't recruit in my second tour, which for an officer and the director of operations means I was a failed case officer by all measures. But there was something about Senegal, and it had to do with the boss that I had there at the time, who's still a family friend. It had to do with where my kids were in their life, you know, in school. And there is just something magical about being in Senegal. So that for me is kind of the tipping point of when I recognize that, yep, I enjoy traveling, because I was a military brat. I grew up in the Hill of the Boot, Italy, Okinawa, Japan, served in Korea myself. So traveling was a huge part of something that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I wanted my kids to grow up in different cultures, learn different languages, and recognize that as great as a nation we have, there are a lot of great countries out there, and I wanted them to be a part of that.
You might not be able to talk about this. Were you there under official cover, or were you a NOC?
I was never a NOC. I only worked official cover State Department from the beginning of my career till I retired in October of 2018.
And did your kids know what you did? At what point did your kids learn what you did versus being a State Department person?
So that's a really, really interesting... it's up to the officer right. to decide when they tell their children, if they ever decide to tell their children what they do. So my son was very young, in fact, too young to actually even utter the three letters. And my daughter was about 5 years older. She was 12, about to turn 13, and very, very, very much like her father in terms of asking questions. Where are you going? Who are you going to see? When are you coming home? You know, when I was about to, you know, launch on my surveillance detection route en route to my meeting. And I knew she was just at the point where she was going to ask the wrong question in the wrong crowd.
Right.
I was the station chief in that particular location. And I just said, you know what, it's time to have the talk. So we planned a father-daughter outing. And we go there the next day. And we're there about 3 or 4 days away from going back to the States for the summer. The family would always leave without me because I couldn't get away for, you know, 4 or 6 weeks at a clip. So they would always go first, and then I would join them, and we would come back together. And I knew they were about to leave, and I wanted to tell her when she was going to be outside of the country we're in and have time to let it all sink in and think back through her whole career, or through my career, but her living it. So we're eating, you know, we're at our favorite little cafe called the Crocodile Cafe, and got to the point in the conversation where that opening was there. So I lean in and I say, you know, Dad brought you here because he really wanted to, you know, share something with you. And she just got the saddest, I can close my eyes and see it now, the saddest look on her face. And she said, you and Mom are getting divorced. Oh. And I look at her and I say, well, not unless you know something that I know, but no, what makes you think that? And she said, well, all my girlfriends who said, oh yeah, if your dad says you got to have a father-daughter meeting, it's not going to be good news. And I said, no, baby, it's not that. We're fine. And I said, but, and then I said, this is who I am. This is who I work for. And she just looked at me like, I don't believe you. And I was really prepared for any response
except for
I don't believe you. So and I was stuck, and she had a little flip phone, and I remember it was banana yellow. And I said, okay, your mom knows why we're here, so you can call her, but the only thing you can say is it true, yes or no? That's it. And then hang up the phone. So she calls and she's looking at me askance, And she says, really? Then she hangs up the phone and immediately starts looking around the cafeteria that we've been in for 30, 45 minutes at this point. And she just, and I said, honey, the only thing that's changed in the last 30 seconds is, you know, nobody else in this restaurant knows. They don't care. Stop looking spooky. Now you're making things a little uncomfortable. And then immediately she looks at me and she says, was it dangerous? Same question that my son had asked 5 years earlier, and I'll get to Josiah in a minute. And I didn't tell him the truth. There are dangerous aspects to the job, but I never ever felt in danger outside of Mogadishu. But anyway, she's looking at me, and I could see the wheels turning. And she says, oh, so that means, and then she ripped off the name of five or six of my classmates from the farm and people who had worked in stations, said, oh, that means they're CIA too. And I look at her and I said, well, honey, I told you could ask me anything, but we can't talk right about other people. So she sits back and she gets this really like satisfied look on her face. And she said, that means, yeah. And she was spot on. She named by name five or six people in a row almost immediately. So clearly she had been thinking about it, and now it just all made sense to her. So she was, like I said, 12, about to turn 13. Now, Josiah, completely different story. Now, Josiah is very, very contemplative, really, really bright kid who at 2 years old was reading. And we knew he was smart. And one day, the nanny had gone home for the day, and the ex was at a board meeting or something. Anyway, I was stuck in the house, and I get a call from, I get a meeting triggered by an agent, and I can't leave a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old in a house alone. So I grab the kids, throw them in the back of the car, go out, do my meeting, get back, and run upstairs, put Olivia back in the bed, come back downstairs, and Josiah is sitting there looking at me. He said, Daddy, why you give that man, and then named what I passed. And I said, well, you know, we've been having trouble with ours, and he gave us this one, but he's looking at me like, no, that doesn't make sense. And he says, well, why were we on Yaya Street? I'm like, we weren't in Yaya's neighborhood. He's like, yes, we were. And we were. I had a car site. I had a meeting site that I could never use again, obviously, because this 7-year-old has figured out that Dad was doing something. And so I said, okay, you got questions, just ask me the question. He said, you're not like the other dads at the embassy. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, all my other friends that are Americans, their dads aren't out 4 or 5 nights a week. And he literally started all the things that a trained collector is supposed to protect from, the Russians, the Chinese, the local service. This 7-year-old had them all just doon, 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 doon. And the first thing I thought is, I must really suck at this because a 7-year-old has figured it out. But he was a smart 7-year-old. Right. So I said, just ask me. And he said, is it dangerous? And I said, no, it's not dangerous. You, your mom, and your sister are fine. And he says, well, are you going to come home from your meetings every time? And I said, well, the reality is anybody could die any time, but don't worry about it. You're 7. You shouldn't be thinking about things like that. But he was 7 and my daughter was 12. Now, I do not recommend ever any CIA officer revealing to a 7-year-old that you work for CIA. I never said CIA. I answered the questions he asked. You're absolutely right. Dad is not like the other fathers. Right. But people are putting their lives in my hands, and me talking to a 7-year-old doesn't make them any safer. So you can never have this conversation with anyone. He will be 30 this year. He has not had that conversation with his mom, who he knows no, or with his sister, who he knows no. He knows that Dad said, you never talk about it, and you never talk about it. So,
yeah. Well, yours was a family affair with your brother and your father. Did either of your kids contemplate following you into the business?
We raised 2 vegetarian hippies. One is an artist in Seattle, and the other is a social worker in Chicago. Their politics are not my politics. But that's how we raised them. to question authority, to push back, to look at things and say, what's the other side of the story that we might not be seeing? But I never imagined that they would turn the tables on their old man and put me in the hot seat and make me question, you know, through the eyes of, you know, adults now. And those are still tough questions to answer. But I have explained to them and anyone else that's willing to listen, I was never asked to do anything that was against my moral or ethical upbringing. I'm a Georgia boy, a Southerner. We're really proud on character, integrity, and a handshake is what you need. Mm-hmm. We don't need to sign a contract. If I look you in your eye and say I'm going to do something, then the expectations are that it's going to be done. So that was, I said, just remember, whatever you've heard about CIA, it's not the full story, and you know who your father is, and you know how you were raised. So just keep that in mind when you're contemplating your negative thoughts about the institution that fed and housed you and clothed you for your entire life. They didn't like that last part of it, but.
Well, there's a place for vegetarian hippies within the agency, even that.
There is, and there are some.
Yes. Well, let me ask you the question that I ask of a lot of people who move to upper management. You rose up the chain to the middle and then upper management. Did it become less fun as you went higher? I mean, was it difficult to remove from the day-to-day? And was it difficult trusting people to do the jobs that you did so well before? I mean, people don't reach the level you did without being good
right
at what they did.
The tough part was when you went from the bullpen, where you're sitting down with the other case officers and the SUs and the CMOs, our other core collectors, and you're part of your discussion how you're going to go about, you know, executing this mission or whether you should at all. And then walking in the room as the first time, you know, manager, and everybody going quiet. And we're like, oh, no, keep talking. Like, no. You're the man now, and until we're ready to present this quasi complete package to you, you know, radio silence. That was a punch in the gut. That was my first job as manager, chief of base in West Africa, and at the end of that tour, the agency sent me to leadership training afterwards, right? And a part of that had to do 360 feedback, where your management back in Washington, your peers in the field, and the subordinates or the direct ports that reported to you all had a say in how you performed as a first-time leader. Well, during this course, and I won't give away the details of it, but there's a reveal on day four of the course that these observers, who you think are instructors, are really clinical psychologists whose job was to look at the information that they had of you and see whether it matched with the feedback that came from the 360 feedback. So on Thursday morning, my clinical psychologist looks at me and he says, are you ready to listen? I'm like, yeah, of course I'm ready to listen. I just come back, just been promoted to GS-14. I was going from being a base chief to a DCOS or a deputy chief of station, so I knew I was the man. Well, I wasn't the man. I was, and it's still even a little painful to talk about, and this was 2002, so 18 years ago. But I knew when that feedback came in that the person I thought I was not the person that I was to the other folks that really mm-hmm. mattered. And it was a turning point. It was cathartic. I think I became a better father. I know at the time, and I'm divorced now, but I know I became a better husband and a better boss because I learned how to listen. And I don't think I was listening before. And it was painful.
Yeah.
It was painful in the sense that I had always, you know, bright student, you know, accolades. And at some point you start to believe your own press. And you stop maybe not trying as hard, but you're just kind of coasting. And coasting isn't what's going to get you to the top ranks of the agency. And so as a part of that process, they had audio tapes, which nobody has audio tapes anymore or audio player in their car. But the tapes, along with the feedback, were given to you on how to improve on the areas where they felt that you could improve in. And for a year, stuck in traffic, listening to and from work, because I had come from West Africa back to the States for a year before going back out, I listened to these tapes. I didn't listen to radio. I didn't listen to anything. I just learned how to improve. I got every book that I could possibly buy. Daniel Pink, Brené Brown, anything that had to do with leadership, I was reading it because I knew I wanted to be, I knew the people that I looked up to within the agency that seemed to do it so seamlessly and effortlessly, and I didn't want to be carbon copies of them, but I wanted to be known as a recognized leader within the institution. And being a Black leader on top of that is even more significant, which I've always, people say I wear my blank on my sleeve. Well, I wear my color on my sleeve and on my hands and my arms and my face. It's who I am.
Right.
But I didn't know that it made all that much difference to the people who were looking up and saying, oh, okay, we can rise up to, be a GS-15 or maybe even make it in an SIS ranks. And that's all I ever wanted to do was be a GS-15. That was my goal walking in the door. Because my dad was he was an enlisted guy and a colonel. You know, you should be proud to be a colonel. And I walked out the door as a 3-star general equivalent.
Right.
And it's still humbling to me to think that, this little kid from Augusta, Georgia, is somebody that people would listen to or look up to there are words that one guy called me a legend, and literally my heart skipped 2 or 3 beats. And I'm like, please don't ever let those words in my name come out in the same sentence.
Well, let me ask you about that because
it's uncomfortable.
Not the legend part, but the idea of was mentorship something that you took very seriously? And was that something that's particularly when you reached the higher levels of CIA, not just for African-American officers, but across the board? I give you an idea. Mary Legere, who was the G2, she was a 3-star general in charge of all Army intelligence.
Yes,
and that was she took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. But the idea of women being in charge of Army intelligence was almost unheard of. And I can potentially see where, we now have a woman director of CIA, which is a huge step forward.
Yes,
but there haven't been a lot of people of color as deputy directors, and certainly hasn't been one of a directorship and anything else. You got very high, not obviously the highest,
right?
But did you look down at the people looking up at you and say, "Okay, come on"?
Absolutely. That was. So for me, you talked about whether it got less, whether going up the chain made things less enjoyable for me. I just learned how to enjoy it in a different way. There is nothing like sitting across from someone playing a chess match and recruiting that check. Intelligence officer or that Al-Qaeda terrorist or whoever it is that you're matched against. That's the ultimate feeling. But I learned that I got just as much enjoyment out of those people who were working for me doing that same thing. And I'm like, okay, this isn't about me anymore. And I really did get as much pleasure seeing that kid who came in knowing nothing and then making it and doing things. And so mentoring was huge. And I wasn't able to do it because I was overseas from 1992 to 2010. I was gone for 18 years. I was never back stateside where I could really, really make a difference. So when we went to the iconic training facility in 2010, I made it a point of giving back. And giving back meant being part of the DO, the Director of Operations Women's Council, of which I was one of the plank holders or one of the early folks involved. The DO African American Council, the Black Executive Board. I did mentoring so the agency paid to train me as a coach. So I learned how to be a coach, and the only thing that I asked was that I not have any clients that were from the DO, because I needed to know more about the other directorates. Mm-hmm. And that was a large part of what I did when I was at the training facility as well. So I learned how to enjoy it through a whole different perspective, a whole different paradigm. And leadership is not anything that leaders don't sit around and think about being leaders. Good leaders sit around and think about how to help that person that might be struggling, or that person who's a water walker, because that's what I ran into in the coaching. You either had the high flyers who everybody, ooh, this lady right here, she's going to be something, or this knucklehead right here, whoo, we're never going to, please, somebody help us. It was almost never anyone in between. I got enjoyment out of helping both because I knew that I could help both, because it's really about listening and perspective and changing people's attitudes or minds about things.
Great.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Let's get back in the Wayback Machine and go to near the beginning of your CIA career. Mm-hmm. You served in Somalia.
I did.
Just after the Task Force Ranger Battle of Mogadishu incident, which has now been, whether you've read about it or watched it in a movie, it's the Black Hawk Down incident.
Absolutely.
It would be tempting to think of that as too little too late or cleaning up the mess, but there was still very important work to be done even after the military pulled out. So let me ask you, what was your main focus as you went into Somalia immediately following that?
So I was the most junior case officer to actually be allowed to go out in an operational capacity to Mogadishu. And that was only because I had been on the Somali working group desk for about 4 months before I went out in January, February of 1994. And of course, that was the last 3 months. We pulled out on the 31st of March. So I was there half of the last 3 months that we were there. And my job was essentially to go out there and get ready for the next phase, get rid of those people that were, you know, basically just taking a paycheck, and hold on to those folks in some capacity, figure out some way to continue to meet with those folks that were out there. I don't think we ever truly left as the CIA, just like we never truly left Afghanistan. And the way we were able to go back after 9/11 was because we had invested in sending people in and keeping contacts warm and making sure people understood that we're still there and we still care and all of that. Even when the rest of the world doesn't care, the CIA is in places, which is why our mobility and getting in and setting up, you know, establishing networks is, it's not luck, people. It's not luck.
Right.
It's someone sitting down and saying, okay, here's the next problem spot in the world. Who speaks this language? Who knows about this? But when we closed our embassy in December of 1989 in Moog, there was that gap between, you know, all the, you know, warlords fighting, then the famine, and of course leading up through Black Hawk. I gotta tell you that as a GS9, which I was at the time, and going to meetings in Mogadishu in a helicopter, that's what people joined the CIA for. It was so surreal to actually be on the ground in a war zone doing things that you knew either saved a life or averted a disaster, or could lead to something crazy or something really beautiful happening. And I enjoyed it. Mogadishu was probably one of those places that was The Black Hawk Down incident was just one day. And we were there long before that, and we've been there since that. And I know that's what people culturally can connect with.
Right.
But a lot of mistakes were made, but there was a lot of good that was done there as well, and is still being done there.
Well, the fact that the mission itself was green lit meant that intelligence got us to a very high level member of, you know, the warlord leadership there.
Right.
You know, not the Farah Adid himself, but to, you know, an underling. Obviously, the mission fails, but the fact that humans and other types of intelligence get us to that point, that's something that's overlooked because of the outcome of the actual operation.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Let me ask you, we know now a lot more about the role of people who would be founders of an organization that didn't quite exist yet, but later become Al-Qaeda.
Right.
How much did we know, or did the CIA know, in the months following the Somalia incident, about how outside influences were involved in any of that?
We knew that there were forces that we couldn't quite explain, because Adid, as crafty and wily as he was, the level of coordination between the different warlords and the different clans was something that they had never seen before. So we didn't know exactly what it was. And then, of course, what became Al-Qaeda, they started bragging that this was the first, this was what Al-Qaeda viewed as their first, you know, black eye for the U.S. intelligence or U.S. government. And I can't, in terms of months, I know within, I'd say within half a year, we had narrowed it down to the folks that were in there on the ground training at the same time that we were in country.
Right.
And we might have gotten some, I mean, I'm sure they've gone back and gone through everything and are able to identify.
It's much easier in hindsight, right?
It is always easier in hindsight. And people need to understand that intelligence is not, we're not magicians. We take a whole bunch of information that we view as facts through corroboration and verification of other sources, and we present them to the policymakers for them to make the decisions. We don't make the decisions. They say go forth, and we do it the best of our ability. But at the end of the day, information is just that. It's for you to use however it is that you can use it, hopefully for good. And intelligence failures, the term intelligence failures is thrown around a little bit too much for my taste.
Right.
Because if you use the same analogy that most people use, then every time there's a crime, it's a law enforcement failure. It just can't be that way. And yes, we've had failures, but I don't think Black Hawk Down was a CIA failure.
Right. Well, let me ask you about the kind of, I think back to the sub-Saharan Africa issues in the 1990s, and this is when I started paying attention. I think a lot of the Americans started paying a lot more attention to what was going on in sub-Saharan Africa because of things like Somalia and Black Hawk Down, because of the civil war in Rwanda, because of what was happening in Darfur and the Sudan.
Right.
A lot of people put a lot of blame on the Clinton administration that they were scared to death after Somalia, that they didn't do anything.
Right.
When it came to Rwanda and Darfur later on. I wonder, you were on the ground. I mean, you were there.
Right.
I'm wondering the perspective of someone on the ground during that time. Was there a role for outside forces, outside agencies, getting between the Hutus and the Tutsis? Was there a role earlier for outside getting involved in Sudan, between North and South Sudan? Is it fair to blame an American administration or anyone else for not getting involved? Maybe the answer is yes.
Right.
But I this is the first time I've sat across literally someone who was on the ground at time. So I do want to ask you about those, because, again, I was a college student and then I was in the military at the time going, why aren't we going in there?
Mm-hmm.
Right. We went into the Balkans to stop a civil war. Why didn't we go into Rwanda when more people were killed in Rwanda than were in the Balkans, and much more disgustingly?
Right.
Yeah.
It's Black History Month, so I'm going to go there.
Go there.
Brown and black peoples throughout history have always not been as important as our European, our European allies and partners. I think that's a mistake. I think the role that Africa has played in the Cold War between the bear and the eagle was significant. I think we're starting to see some of that again with China's expansion into Africa. But in terms of what you asked, I did spend a little time in Burundi in the aftermath of the Hutu Tutsi massacres. In fact, close to 3 months. No, more than 3 months. And I don't know if there was anything that could have been done on the Hutu Tutsi side of it. Somalia, Clinton was not in the door. In fact, it was during the lame duck period of, you know, Clinton took office on the 20th of January and we pulled out on the 31st of March. He was handed from George Bush a huge problem and American blood in a country that most people couldn't find on a map. So he probably came in and said, you know what, why am I going to start my time as president embroiled in a part of the world that we really don't care about, and right, let's go ahead and pull out. There's a lot of back and forth and a lot of politics, of course, that were involved, but you can't fault, you know, an administration not wanting to, you know, continue you know, a failed policy, or what was perceived as a failed policy. I know a lot of people talk about in the mid-90s that the CIA had lost its way, you know, the bear had fallen and we just were floundering. We didn't see that in Africa Division. We didn't have time for that in Africa right. Division. And people who don't know how the agency is divided, but where I spent the lion's share of my career was on the African continent and not chasing Africans. We're chasing Russians and Chinese and North Koreans and Iranians and terrorists. That never stopped. It never waned. Now, we knew who the enemy was. We knew who Russia was. But it was a whole lot harder not knowing who Al-Qaeda was, not knowing who all the different splinter groups that were out there were coming around. And it was, for me, it was like being a kid in a candy store. Russians are hard, they're hard targets for, you could spend your entire career at CIA and never engage a Russian in a meaningful way as a human collector. But that's not the case when you have all these other, you know, all these other, you know, pieces of jewels that are out there that you can get to. So for me and for young officers, and I was, again, in the very beginning of my career, it was the best time for me between 95 and 2005. I'm excited just sitting here thinking about it.
There's not a visual, but he just looks giddy. He's just kind of giggling. Giddy.
Yeah, giddy is probably right.
Well, let me. So we haven't had anyone on the podcast since I've run it, so over the last 6 years, who can speak about African issues in any concrete or intelligent way. So forgive me for doing what so many others do, that I rail on them when I speak of Africa as some kind of monolithic body.
Right, exactly.
And not a continent full of dozens and dozens of independent states. However, I'd like to talk broad issues versus specific countries. I think you can probably talk a lot more, mm-hmm. you know, from your ability to not have things classified, to talk about broad things versus specific issues. And kind of doing the reading that, excuse me, that's led up to this conversation, mm-hmm. I've tried to figure out what are some of the big issues facing Africa, sub-Saharan Africa today. Almost universally, looking at things like bad governance and corruption, and that question, of course, goes to, even if the agency is working very closely with, or the United States government is working very closely with some of these countries, if we can't get aid to the right people, and that's right. what we saw in Somalia, of course,
exactly,
then it's very difficult to us to engage directly mm-hmm. with these countries. Do you still see that as a key issue moving forward in Africa today?
You know what? Not so much. So when I joined the agency in 1990, there were zero, literally zero examples of transfer of power from one African leader to another through the ballot box. It just didn't happen. Coups happened in two of the places that I lived in. I had a king die in a third, which of course leads to upheaval. These things happen all the time on all over the world. But if you look at today, Senegal, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, and I know I'm missing some.
Ethiopia, with Abiy Ahmed, right. Who just got the Nobel Peace Prize.
So you have all these countries that now have democratically elected leaderships and a transfer of power that was not a coup, that no one lost any lives. And it just, I think there's so much hope on that continent. And it's, I miss being in Africa. So I went back as chief of Africa division. I was traveling with the DDO, the deputy director of operations, and went back to East Africa, and actually went back to my first posting 22 years after the fact, and went back to Mogadishu 22 years after being there. And it was good to see it from the perspective of an adult, a grown man looking at it strategically as opposed to being on the ground and doing it tactically. There's a lot of promise on that continent. There's a lot of money. The human potential of, you know, just Africa writ large. And I'm laughing because I had can't remember where I was, but this brother heard that I had lived in Africa. He's like, "Oh, you speak African." I was like, I said, "Dude, do me a favor. Whatever you do, don't ever use that sentence again with anyone." I was like, "There's no such language. There's Afrikaan,
right?
But there's no African language." And I think at the time I had just come from Nigeria, which has probably 400 or 500 dialects. And oh my God, I don't know how many states they have in, but there's a lot of languages just within that one nation. And, you know, it's a former British colony, so of course we all spoke English, but everybody else there spoke 3 or 4 languages,
right?
And not languages that I would understand, or anyone, not many in the audience. Huge potential there. Lot more collaboration between us and the leaders of these countries. They know where we are and how we're coming out, because it's not, you know, the Russians are going to give us this if the Americans. It's not that kind of thing. When I first got to Senegal, the Senegalese had just recognized Taiwan over China, which of course is a power play and a money play and all of this, and it's probably flipped back and forth a couple of times since then. So people were able to play one side off against the other. They couldn't do that in the aftermath in the mid-90s when Russia was still basically they were broke.
Yeah.
It was a TKO, and it took them a long time to recover, which leads to a former KGB guy who never wants to revisit what that period was in their life and why he's so staunch and wanting to stay there, thinking I'm the only one who can do this. That's what every leader thinks. You know, Museveni in Uganda, and yes, I threw that out there because they're about to have an election, and he was one of the good guys who in the 80s pushed out this despot that had been there too long, and I believe he's coming close to being the person that he fought against.
Right.
But I've also met him. He is a fantastic leader. He is a very, very strong supporter of a lot of things that the United States needs, you know, in the United Nations level, LGBTQ issues aside. But he's a leader that hopefully will do the right thing.
Well, I remember, to interrupt you, you mentioned people staying there too long. If I recall, when Robert Mugabe came to power,
right,
he was like the future of Africa. He was someone that, and then of course, that went straight to hell.
Yes,
as he got there longer and longer, and that, you know, Idi Amin, you know, get rid of him and then bring somebody else in has been there a little too long.
Right,
I think that's where kind of this peaceful transfer of power in Ethiopia again is, you know, looking. The reason that he was given the Nobel Peace Prize is because, I mean, I grew up remembering We Are the World and Ethiopia starving and everything else like that. And now they're the second most populous country, and it's like number one in Africa. GDP is growing like 10% a year, and it's got this peaceful transfer. But that's what's interesting. I saw the statistic. About half of the world's fastest growing economies are in Africa, with 20 economies expected to grow at 5% or more over the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. And you listed most of them.
That is fantastic news.
But they're still, I mean, that's going to run up into some of the issues that I want to talk to you about. of things like overpopulation, things like resource scarcity.
Right.
One thing that no one thinks about, well, not no one, most people are so focused on, they think resources, they think oil. Right. Because we've been fighting for oil for the last 100 years. Water, arable, edible, you know, potable water in Africa is where there's going to be wars fought over that in the future. And with climate change and that kind of stuff happening, there's another interesting statistic, and this is that 9 out of 10 countries in the world most vulnerable to climate change are in sub-Saharan Africa.
I believe that.
9 out of 10. Because the region has at least 10 vulnerable coastal cities with a population of more than 1 million people, including Accra, Dakar, Durban, Lagos, that climate change is going to push people out of those areas, and there's not a lot of space already. And that, to me, is if you don't have the infrastructure, if you don't have good populace, if you don't have good leadership, if corruption is there, it's kind of asking for it. I mean, that to, you know, why aren't we paying more attention to this?
I think corruption is inherent in most societies. No matter, you know, the mafia was able to be the mafia because they took advantage of Italian immigrants when they first to the United States. The Irish mafia took care, you know, took advantage of the Irish, you know, immigrants and so on and so on. Don't matter whether you're Vietnamese, Hmong, if you have a mafia or, you know, bad guys in your area, they're coming after you first. What we've been able to do in Africa is the leaders are better. I mean, the communication and the information that's out there is just so, it's harder to hide. You can't do what people did when I walked in the door in 1990 because it's almost immediately going to be captured by somebody. And these leaders know that, and they can't, no matter you think you have complete control of your country, Saddam Hussein didn't have complete control of Iraq. Gaddafi didn't have complete control of Libya, but they had solid control that just doesn't exist in the African context. And I never served south of the equator, so Mugabe was just a complete. I never understood. Did you see the man? He was frail. How are you afraid of this 90-year-old man? He can hurt no one. They were deathly afraid of him. In my job as deputy director of CTC, I would meet with the liaison folks who had come through, everything from Austria to Zimbabwe. And I remember talking to the Zimbabweans just, you know, off the record, like, what? I'm not saying you should do one thing or another, but what is it about? You would talk about Mugabe like he was God.
Well, Fidel Castro was similar to that.
Afraid of, yes. Yes.
I mean, in some of the Soviet leaders were half dead, and they still were able to keep power.
Andropov was dead.
So let me ask you this then. I mean, the idea of educational standards now growing, which is fantastic. There's a massive amount of economic investment moving down there now. Some of it's the Chinese, which is somewhat problematic, but the African Union is doing a pretty good job. They are now running into some of the same kind of first world problems we are of having now homegrown terrorist organizations of Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram and others that, especially places like Kenya and Nairobi, these are top economies that are being slowed because of not just, this isn't just Muslim terrorism, but this is the idea of just terrorism writ large. That has to be, I mean, I think that's why AFRICOM was beefed up. That's why we shifted a lot of focus to that. Are you worried that that's going to slow down? Again, as the former deputy director of the Counterterrorism Center, as somebody who knows Africa better than anybody, do you see terrorism as kind of a key issue that is going to slow down the ability of Africa to move into the 21st century?
It won't stop it, but it'll definitely slow it. Those cities in Nigeria that are impacted by, and there was an Al-Shabaab attack where I read today, I think they burned 18 people that were in a caravan sleeping and just burned them alive where they were. Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram for Nigeria. Al-Shabaab has been, I've been chasing Al-Shabaab in some form since my time in Mogadishu. They don't have the power, or they don't have they don't have the backing amongst the people in their own country, so they're limited to what they're going to be able to do. There's enough people inside Somalia now, from, you know, Somalia, Somaliland, all the way down to the Kenyan border. It's not just the Americans or just our Five Eye partners. You have the Turks that are in there. You have Eastern Europeans. You have a lot of people who have their own, you know, ways of setting up programs for building schools or building, you know, sanitation system, taking care of the people. Because whether you were in the days of Moses or in the current days, if you take care of the people under your charge, they will back you. And when you have ISIS coming into places in Syria and doing better than what the Syrian government did, then these people are going to back ISIS. The same thing with Boko Haram.
Right.
The same thing with Al-Shabaab. The same thing with, you know, fill in the blank. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, the people who get attracted to these groups, very small percentage of them are really hardcore bad people. These are people who just want to live through the day and want to connect with someone, who want to belong to something, who want to do something that, you know, that means something. And for them, it means within their religion. But one of the best discussions I ever had was with a 90-year-old, my girlfriend's mom, and she's a psychotherapist, very, very bright. And she's like, "Daryl, tell me about this ISIS." And for about 45 minutes, she just asked the most interesting questions. And she was a World War II Italian war bride who grew up with, you know, the Nazis marching around on the streets of Florence, and her as a 16 to 19 year old kid seeing all of this stuff. So she knows what this can be. And I told her, "I'm not worried, because there's going to be someone who joined ISIS for their own purposes, who's going to get to the theater and recognize that this is not what I signed on for.
Yeah.
I don't want to destroy, you know, art that can never be replicated. I don't want to put people in cages and burn them alive. I don't want anything to do with this." But now they're trapped.
Right.
But they're looking for an out. And they're looking for an out, whether they get recruited by a Kurd or an Iraqi or a CIA or a British MI6 or whoever happens to be there. And that person, because they're a part of ISIS, is going to get us to al-Baghdadi, is going to get us to UBL, is going to get us to, you know, the leader of Boko Haram at the time. I don't know if he's still the leader.
It's like,
I
think the number two guy at ISIS was like the world's shortest job, because it was like they just died every week.
Actually, at Al-Qaeda, it's the number three job.
Yeah, the number three at Al-Qaeda.
You did not want that job.
But BH, Boko Haram, has had so many different leaders. They've killed themselves. They get killed by Western intelligence. So let me ask you this, the final question, kind of the big issue is, Africa is one of the youngest populations, but by per capita, it's got a young, potentially vibrant population that is going to know computers better than everybody else, is going to be able to be in the workforce for the next 50 years, is going to be able to change the infrastructure. They can build roads, they can build 5G internet, everything else. Or if they have no jobs, they can join Boko Haram. It seems this crossroad period now, more than ever before, it's similar to, if you look at kind of the Palestinian question, but this is now a continent that, again, we want to group everybody together. It's not monolithic, but a lot of that Central African area with all the fake country names, like the Central African Republic's not a republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo is not democratic or republic or anything else. But there are a lot of 25-year-olds who are looking for something to do.
Right.
We're kind of a now or never. I mean, that's from my perspective. I kind of want to throw that in your direction. Do you see that the same way? Is this where the United States government and the Western economies should be just dumping money and resources in Africa? Or are we really missing the boat? Is this now the only time that we can do this?
So the first thing that crossed my mind is between 2013 and 2015, I was in two different jobs at CIA headquarters, one in the counterterrorism center and then heading Africa division. And at the time, there was a lot of discussion about the agency and doing modernization and making changes, and how we were living in the worst time in the history of mankind. And I remember challenging the leadership and saying, I think there were two world wars and, and a Korean War and a Vietnam War, and that's just the American wars. I don't think we're living in the worst possible time. We tend to think, oh my God, it's now or never. People think that the issues that we're having as a nation now began in 2016. They did not begin in 2016. This administration is, quite frankly, and I work for every president from Reagan to Trump, is not any worse off than anybody right. else. It's just all about perspective. People, I'm a trained intelligence officer. My job is not to take one side or the other. I don't care who the president is. When they walk into that job, they are so unprepared
right.
for the amount of danger that exists in this world. People ask me, what was the most dangerous? You don't want to know the most dangerous thing that I've seen. You don't. I'm telling you, you don't want to know.
Well, just... I always thought that when presidential elections, and I'm taking us on a tangent, but it's an important one. Presidential elections, there's two questions that no one ever answers honestly. The first is, how old were you when you knew you wanted to be president? Because every single one of them should say 5 years old. They're right. all like, well, when I saw the poor and whatever, you're full of shit. It's when you're 5 years old. And the second question is, who do you think is most prepared to be president? And the answer to that is none of us.
Right.
Right. Literally no one standing up here is prepared to be president.
No, not really.
There's not a single person, even if you've been vice president,
I agree.
A single person is in that big chair in that big office and understands
and it matters.
That. Yep. And it matters. And I think that, you know, the learning curve for everybody
mm-hmm.
is extreme. I don't care. You know, Obama was a constitutional lawyer. His learning curve is just as much as George yes. H.W. Bush, who was a CIA director.
Correct.
Because you go from being the briefer to the briefee, and you're in a very
right.
different seat.
Exactly. The 25-year-olds out there who are trying to figure out whether they're going to, you know, and it's not an either or, I'm going to join a terrorist group or I'm going to, you know, design 6G, if there is such a 7G, whatever the next G is going to be. But we are losing a lot of people. But now we now have close to 20 years of collaboration between the United States and its allies across the world on countering the homegrown, you know, terrorist,
mm-hmm.
whether it's here in the United States or whether it's in Belgium or whether it's in N'Djamena. It's really the same paradigm and the same process. You're going to have to adapt it, of course, to the environment that you're in, but hope is a powerful thing. When people feel like their voices are not being heard, they act out. I don't care if you got a toddler and you're not paying attention to that toddler, what are they going to do? Yeah. They're going to act out and they're going to get your attention. It doesn't change. You're still a toddler, whether you're 30 or 80. There's a part of you that's still a toddler, and people want to feel like they have a say.
Yeah.
Like what I matter. And that changes everything. The shirt that I have on today is one of the things I wanted to do in part of leadership after I got out was volunteer more. I have a very socially conscious children. Daughter's a social worker. What are you doing to give back? So I work with foster youth.
Mm-hmm.
And the times where I get like that bright look in their eye, like that spark where they see that there's a possibility of them living beyond the craziness of their lives, and they've lived. None of them have good stories. These are children who have been taken away from families for reasons that have nothing to do with them.
Right.
But they're the ones that are trapped in it. But hope is a powerful thing. And hope is one of those things that I think can spread across any language, across any culture, across any year, week, decade. And hope has to be, not the whole keep hope alive, all that.
Yeah.
None of that. Just give people a reason not to join a terrorist group. Nobody, if you want to join a terrorist group, there's nothing that any of
right.
us going to do to stop you. It's those fringe guys. It's those ones who are trying to figure out where they fit in life. And if they feel like they're never going to fit anywhere in whatever world they're growing up in, they're going to be recruited in the same way that I recruited by people who have, you know, nefarious intentions.
Right. Well, Daryl, we really appreciate you taking the time today. I mean, I'm looking forward to talking to you for a while once we scheduled you to come to the museum for other things. I'm like, I gotta get Daryl to come in. So we truly appreciate your time, the fascinating conversation. Again, I apologize for treating Africa as one big country. No, we didn't have time to break it down.
Nope, that's fine.
And again, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.